everyone. My name is Mary Texera, and I am a past professor of sociology at Cal State San Bernardino. We have this wonderful program that we're very, very proud of that we want to continue today. And we have two guests that we think that you'll really, really love in terms of a critical eye on law enforcement. These are special guests. Well, one is a very special guest because he is returning. We love when our students return, and he's returning as not a student anymore. He has his doctorate, and I can't wait for you to meet him. And so with that, I will turn the program over to Robbie Madrigal, who will introduce himself and do our land acknowledgement.
Thank you, Mary. My name is Robbie Madrigal. I'm from the Fowle Library and also would like to extend a welcome to our special guest today. I'll go ahead and read the land acknowledgement. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since its founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. And now I'll pass it over to my colleague, Amber Broaden.
Peace, everyone. My name is Amber Broaden. I serve as an adjunct faculty in the psychology department at both CSU Dominguez Hills and San Bernardino with a specialization in legal and forensic psychology. I'll pass it over to my colleague, Michael German.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike German. I'm a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice and formerly served as an FBI special agent. It's my pleasure to introduce our guests. Daniel Gascon is an assistant associate professor at the sociology department at the University of Massachusetts Boston, a research fellow at the Mauricio Gascon Institute for Latino Community Development and Public Policy. He's the founding director of the Racial Justice Laboratory. Daniel's current research combines sociology, criminal justice, law, and history. His recent solo authored work appears in the journals Critical Sociology and Social Justice, and he is the lead author of the March 2024 book, Police and State Crime in the Americas, Southern and Postcolonial Perspectives with the Palgrave Macmillan Publishing. L.J. Frierman is an alum from the University of Massachusetts Boston Sociology Department and the Bunker Hill Community College Liberal Arts Department. They are currently a lab assistant at the Racial Justice Laboratory. Daniela and LG, welcome to the program. Really interested in hearing what you have to say. You're on mute, Daniel.
Thanks everyone for this great invitation. It's such an honor to be back at my alma mater speaking. You know, you don't know how much it means to me to be able to be here and share my work, our work. This is a great time for all of you to be reviewing this work because we are at the stage where we're still kind of going back and forth with the journal, and we would really love any feedback that you all have to maybe make this work more impactful or clearer. In any case, we're really excited to show you what we've got. So let me start us off here. A second, I'm sorry. Okay. So this work is based in Boston before Michael Cox. As I said, we are currently in the process of, we have an R&R with the journal, the Du Bois Review, and we're hoping to turn that into an accept very soon. We actually just turned in our second version and we're hoping to hear back on that. I wanted to start us off with this figure, Michael Cox, who in 2022 was appointed a police commissioner after having himself suffered civil rights at the hands of the Boston Police Department while working as an officer. What happened in 1995, he was in a hot pursuit for a robbery suspect working in a plainclothes gang unit at the time when four of his uniformed colleagues found him and caught up with him and mistook him for a plainclothes officer and then beat him severely about the head and about the head and hands. And he suffered a concussion, a number of injuries. And when officers at the scene discovered that he was himself also a fellow officer, they fled the scene. And that set off a long chain of events where officers basically prevented the truth from coming to light for a very long period. Because of the department's foot dragging over that long period, eventually Michael Cox, within 6 months, filed a suit against the city and eventually won. It took several years, but he won $1 million settlement against the city. And in the initial suit, he claimed that the department fails to investigate allegations of misconduct by police, fails to properly supervise their officers and train their officers, and that they are especially engaged in misconduct against Black male suspects and other powerless citizens, as he described them. Since taking over in 2022, he takes over a department that still has a number of the same problems of brutality, corruption, and racism. You take, for instance, the fact that since the 1970s, the department has been sued over 10 times for its problematic employment discrimination policies. Not only that, but in 2019, the ACLU of Massachusetts also sued the department over its violation of the First Amendment by way of usage of its surveillance policies and its gang database management system. More recently, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, using the department's own records, show that they disproportionately encounter and stop and arrest young Black and Latino men in specific neighborhoods of the city, such as Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. Now, why are we conducting this research in Boston? Well, first off, Boston is a very notable city, at least in historical and criminological terms. Many times historians think of Boston as the cradle of liberty. I mean, this is the beginning of the abolitionist movement. It's also, in terms of law enforcement, the birthplace of the first professional police force, you know, born on modern liberal principles. By the late 20th century, criminologists were regarding Boston and its police department as a miracle for achieving significant reductions in violent crime at a time when nationally rates of violence were skyrocketing. But the reality is that the city of Boston is deeply, deeply segregated, and that historically its police have violated the law despite both of their longstanding liberal and progressive reputations. The city of Boston, for instance, has rates of inequality that are significantly high. For instance, if you take nearly every domain of life, and LG will expand on this a little further, but nearly in every domain of life, Black inequality is felt very, very deeply. Not only that, but if you take a look, for example, at the badge on the right, the police department has this number at the very bottom etched 1854 to denote the year of its founding. However, this belies its involvement in enacting the 1850 fugitive slave law, in which, and that's the flyer that you see right behind the badge there, in which the officers in Boston were the very first police department in the nation to enact this law, and which essentially brought slave patrols to the North, a tradition in law enforcement that we attribute to the South. And what we hope to accomplish with this case study is to reckon with this underexamined history. And there are, if you're watching HBO or if you're watching Netflix, there's a number of documentaries sort of revealing the history of racial tensions in Boston since the 80s and 90s. And that's really the kind of conversation we're hoping to have more broadly. And so we hope to challenge this idea that the city is just a liberal bastion. And these are our central research questions. How does the Cox beating fit within this larger context surrounding Black freedom, the Black freedom struggle in Boston, specifically against police civil rights violations? How does the incident highlight Boston's history of racial inequality and segregation? And what does Boston's history tell us about policing and civil rights organizing in the United States? And with that, I'll turn it over to LG.
Thank you, Professor Gascon. Thank you guys for having us today. I'm LG. Policing the police in general refers to popular demands for police accountability, transparency, and reform. However, it's also a lingering civil rights battle. Leading figures from MLK to Malcolm X to the Black Panther Party spoke on these issues, reflecting many of the same concerns that Black Lives Matter activists highlight today. Since at least the 1930s, we have found that there have been sustained public calls for improved measures to police the police throughout the United States. The crimes that police most often need to be held accountable for are referred to as crimes committed under the color of law. It's a crime for law enforcement officers to deprive any person of their federally protected rights or impose differential punishments based on race. Section 242 of the Federal Criminal Code imposes criminal penalties on any person who acts under color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, who willfully subjects any person to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution or laws of the U.S., or to different punishments, pains, or penalties on account of such person being an alien or by reason of his color or race than are prescribed for the punishment of citizens. The U.S. v. Cruikshank's decision is influential in defining police civil rights violations for the court because of the precedent that it set that reduced congressional power to hold individuals liable for civil rights violations. This case involved the federal prosecution of William Cruikshank and eight other KKK members for the killing of 100 Black citizens in Colfax during what is now called the Colfax Massacre. In this decision, the Supreme Court said that prosecutors must prove the defendant's specific intent to discriminate against another person in order to activate the due process clause of the 14th Amendment in cases involving collective racial violence. Since then, the federal government has treated police involvement in racially motivated civil rights violations as a patently local crime, which gives local authorities full responsibility to investigate and litigate these crimes. However, the historic record shows they rarely do either. The Black Boomerang is where all of the cases that we detail in this study took place. Throughout the 20th century, in-migrating Black populations from various regions of the diaspora have been largely confined due to both de facto segregation and systemic inequality to the Black Boomerang, which is this little boomerang-shaped strip in Boston comprised of the neighborhoods Mission Hill, Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. In the late 40s, Michael Cox's parents moved to Boston, becoming a part of the larger Great Migration of Blacks out of the South from the early to mid 20th century. And by the year 1960, Boston's neighborhoods were deeply segregated by race, with a disproportionate distribution of whites in the suburbs and Blacks in the city center. For instance, Roxbury, which was previously integrated with Blacks and white Jews, saw the Jewish people move with white flight into the suburbs during the 1950s. Michael Cox was born in 1965 at the height of Boston's civil rights movement. This was only 2 months after the NAACP branch won its lawsuit against the city for its segregated and underserved public school system, leading to court-mandated busing about a decade later, and also 2 months after MLK led a march from the Carter Playground in Roxbury to the Boston Common downtown. Far beyond housing and schooling, however, Black Bostonians now and historically have endured inequalities in nearly every domain of life. For instance, employment discrimination in Boston saw the "Don't Buy Where You Can't Work" campaign, and there has been, and it still is, a staggering wealth gap between Blacks and Latinos and whites in Boston. Since Cox was born, crime has become an increasingly salient problem in the Black Boomerang. The late 60s and early 70s saw a rise in drug-related crime that would last for the next decade plus. By the late 1980s, Boston had a serious problem with drug-selling gangs and territorial violence, especially amongst youth under the age 24. And so now we'll move into the cases that we're looking at in the study in Boston's movement to police the police. So excessive police force was a central concern amongst many groups and figures during the early years of civil rights organizing. One case served to catalyze Boston's larger movement. On July 8th, 1934, George Borden, a black janitor from Roxbury, was eating dinner with his wife and young children when a city motor vehicle inspector Everett Gardner and police patrolman William Harmon appeared at his door armed but in civilian clothing. They served Borden an arrest warrant for an outstanding parking violation. Borden, who had previous negative experiences being arrested for minor crimes, attempted to flee the scene, and this led to a police chase that ended with Gardner shooting Borden. Borden would die about a week later from gunshot wounds. After the shooting, Boston's legal actors moved quickly to absolve the law enforcement officials. The two officers gave false testimony at the trial. They said that Borden threatened them with a revolver. This contrasted with Borden's bedside testimony, which never entered the court record, in which he denied ever owning a gun. Gardner was acquitted by Judge Albert Hayden on all charges. But civil rights groups were determined to hold Gardner accountable, and they demanded justice for Borden's death and retribution against Gardner, Harmon, and the RMV. A funeral that doubled as a public demonstration was held for Borden by the League of Struggle for Negro Rights and the International Labor Defense. On October 30th, Borden's family brought charges against Gardner, who was issued an arrest warrant but let go on a $1,000 bond. However, the RMV did suspend him, and 2 years later, Borden's widow was awarded $1,000 by the city. While civil rights groups may not have succeeded in securing a conviction in their case, they did galvanize the city civil rights movement for years to come. In 1949, Muriel and Otto Snowden, two black social workers, formed the Freedom House in Roxbury. This was a center for black civil rights organizing, and they hosted social educational events. Archival evidence shows that the Freedom House became a focal point of black civil rights organizing. And throughout its early years, police protection or lack thereof was a central concern. Over the next decade and a half, organizers in New York were becoming increasingly aware of the deeply rooted culture of brutality amongst urban police. In a 1948 speech, Dan Dodson, director of the New York Unity Committee, argued that officers lack sufficient training in the field. Within 5 years, Freedom House organizers began pointing to similar conditions of differential treatment and brutality amongst urban police, and proposing police reform measures. Specifically, Muriel Snowden wanted to diversify the Boston police force by adding more Black officers, and she thought that this would mitigate the differential treatment that they were fighting against. Jump to about a decade later, the so-called Roxbury riot occurred during a period of widespread urban rebellions around the country and provoked local organizers to embrace Black power, cultural nationalism, and militant strategies to combat excessive force. This took place on June 2nd, 1967. Mothers for Adequate Welfare, or MAW, staged a protest at the Grove Hall Welfare Office. They locked themselves inside the building with employees using bike chains and police wearing full riot gear and wielding billy clubs broke through the crowd and entered the building. The crowd began throwing projectiles at the police, and eventually this erupted into a full-scale riot, which resulted in injuries, arrests, and property damage. Archival footage shows that in the days after the riots, mall leaders spoke to the press to clarify the group's intentions. Doris Bland, the founder of MAW, appeared on TV and read the demands aloud to cut off checks on hearsay or malicious gossip, to remove police officers from the welfare office, for caseworkers to be present at the office every day, for social workers to stop verbally abusing their clients, and most importantly, for Welfare Commissioner Daniel Cronin to be dismissed and replaced by someone chosen and approved of by MAW. The mob organizers and city leaders had opposing views on what sparked the riots. While the mob organizers saw their form of protest as peaceful, the police perceived it as aggressive and in response became violent. Mayor John Collins had several responses planned and hoped that they would help keep the peace. He wanted to appoint a fact-finding committee to further investigate the disturbances. He wanted to hold public hearings with Cronin, Ma, and other interested parties to discuss improving the welfare system. And he placed Black clergymen and lawyers inside three Roxbury police stations and an officer within Operation Exodus, which was a Black parent-led school desegregation initiative in Roxbury. All of this was to ensure instant communication. It's unclear how long these lines of communication remained open or how long these placements lasted, but it is clear that police further saturated Roxbury over the next year. This increased police presence led to more explosive conflicts, tensions, and escalations in violence, which was a nationwide issue. Organizers and young people held protests during this period to bring attention to the systemic abuses they were enduring. The simmering tensions were a sign that Black organizers and young people in Roxbury were becoming increasingly militant and legalistic in response to systemic racism. Many civil rights organizations formed throughout the city, and a key turning point was a speech from Stokely Carmichael, Prime Minister of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Carmichael, in his speech, observed the infighting amongst Black organizations and urged them to put their differences aside and form a united front. Days later, the leaders of dozens of Black organizations met and agreed to form the Boston Black United Front, which was a militant, activist, and legalistic coalition. Their primary goal was to hold police officers accountable for the shootings of unarmed Black men. The organizations that comprised the front included the Black Panther Party and the NAACP. And many others. It was led by local activists, including Chuck Turner and Leonard Durant, and it organized four major actions from 1970 to 72 in response to police shootings. One of these key instances was a community trial for Walter Duggan in the case of Walter Duggan versus Black people. More than 700 people attended as a community-led jury found Walter Duggan guilty for the murder of Franklin Lynch, and he was sentenced to a public shaming. This is called Poster Day, and you can see on the slide here a poster featuring Duggan's name, address, picture, and charges was posted all over the city of Boston. Back to you.
Thank you. By the late 20th century, police were a mainstay in the Black community all throughout the Black boomerang. Saturations were really a response to the increasing rate of crime at that time. While in the past you had seen civil rights groups involved and activists and organizing in the community, Black activist clergy took a much more prominent role in the late 80s into the 90s. And part of this was done in response to the crime epidemic that was going on at the time, but also there was a need to kind of inspire public unity, public trust, not only in the police department, but the government itself, all of whom were struggling not only with this mounting rate of crime, but also struggling with a crisis of legitimacy at that time. Part of the challenge you had, or one of the more significant cases that we saw at that time was the false arrest of Willie Bennett. This was a response to the murder of Carol Stewart, who we later learned was actually killed by her husband, who killed her for the insurance money. He falsely accused a random black man for committing the crime, and police, without much of an investigation into the veracity of his statements, descended upon the Mission Hill projects, and for the next 90 days conducted a mass stop and frisk operation. They stopped about 150 people per day. And in some of the worst instances, they actually sexually assaulted young men. The young man complained both to the ACLU, to the department itself, and to city officials that police officers would pull their pants down in full public view, they would just be involved in very invasive searches. Under increasing pressure from this, as a result of this incident, the city mayor at the time organized the St. Clair Commission to try and bring about some recommendations for change. But those recommendations really never came to pass. When they were publicized, it was recommended that the department do away with the police commissioner and that they reorganize the department to better suit the needs of the community. But none of that went very far. Immediately after the recommendations were made public, the city mayor disbanded the group. None of those folks who were harmed as a result of the mass stop and frisk operation, either Willie Bennett or the Mission Hill residents, ever saw justice for the abuses they've suffered. They brought a civil suit against the city, but were unsuccessful in that suit. Afterward, Black ministers were among the loudest critics, including Reverend Raylan Scotland Hager of the Community United Church, who likened both the actions of the city mayor and the police department to the KKK. However, these historically high rates of crime and serious violence really provoked Black ministers to band together. There was one instance in particular in which there was a gang fight in a church during a memorial service for someone who had been killed in a drive-by shooting. And it was really that kind of instant, that moment that helped to crystallize these men to speak out against crime and to work with police and other city agencies to reduce crime. So these ministers kind of really helped to mobilize their own congregations, other churches, the police department. You know, they started holding clergy patrols to go out and proselytize to people in the community. They used these as occasions to bring people into church initiatives and to try and reduce crime. They started to work with probation officers and share information. And over time, it really had a significant impact on the rate of crime that we saw in the city. Another caveat here is that the ministers also went out in front of the police department to really speak on behalf of them to the Black community and to try and cool tensions when they did arise and also speak to the professionalism of the department. So they were really responsible for helping to cool public sentiment, even in cases of police abuse, because it was seen as a lesser of the two evils. Youth violence was so significant at the time that it was seen as a lesser of the two evils. So what did we learn at the time is that while these Black ministers were shielding the department under their umbrella, this was at the same historic moment in 1995 when Cox's case was unfolding. Right, when you see the improper investigations, when you see misconduct both on the part of officers throughout the rank and file, but also in the leadership of the department. The federal court didn't intervene in many of these cases or didn't necessarily find a reason to side with plaintiffs, but they did in Cox's case. And there might be a lot of reasons for that, especially given the amount of evidence there was in his case, maybe in contrast to some of these others, but his was definitely different in that respect. Their court decision is not the only historical break we should consider. There's a lot of other continuities in this story as well. In particular, the increasing criminalization of Black youth over the course of the 20th century. So whereas initially it was the figure of the Black man that became criminalized, toward the mid-century, Black women, Black mothers became a symbol of criminality. And by the end of the century, you saw much more of a focus on perceived youth gangs and youth violence in the city. One of the more significant paradoxes we continue to struggle with is why Boston continues to have this sort of mythical status, both as a liberal bastion and as the very first professional police force, as if that meant that the department was exceptional, that it didn't have any kind of racist history when it actually does. And we hope that this work really helps to continue to dispel that myth. We really wanted to thank the organizers of the Conversations on Race and Policing for having us here. All of the support we've received at UMass Boston from the Sociology Department and the Gaston Institute, as well as our supporters internationally. Thank you very much. If anyone has any questions, even after this talk, please feel free to reach out. Both of us would be very happy to to engage with you. Thank you very much.
That was excellent. Thank you all so much for sharing so much information. At this time, there aren't any Q&A questions that have popped up yet. Again, feel free to add your questions so that our speakers can respond. But I do have a couple of things that I would like to share. Again, just a deep appreciation for how in-depth you all went with this discussion. There was one case in particular that I tell my students about. It was an operation within the local police department in San Francisco called Operation Zebra. They were looking for the zebra killers. And in that case, they had detained 600 Black men that fit a general profile that the department was given. And so that reminds me heavily of Willie Bennett's case as well, right? This over-policing of Black and brown bodies. Another interesting connection that I made was also the Moynihan report that was released within the 70s, right? Yeah. Where it talks about essentially Black people must find a way to overcome the tragedies and prejudice that they've experienced, right? It's almost as if, and please correct me or speak in on this as well, Daniel, but most of the historic racism that we've experienced is not necessarily systemic, right? It's sometimes things that we have allowed to happen within the community that we need to almost situate our bootstraps and rise above from. Have you looked at that in your research as well?
I have a student group now that's doing work trying to link the Moynihan Report with other other ways of sort of framing the Black motherhood at the time, and are also trying to link it up with how the larger welfare movement unfolded. So I think you're right on. I think there's some students who are really trying to bring out those threads right now. Yeah.
Amber, if I may, I remember the Moynihan report, and for me, because I was doing research on Black women, for me, the bottom line was Black mothers were blamed for the actions of their children, as Daniel just sort of implied. And so it wasn't, and of course his solution was make them get married. You know, they need to get married, and you don't realize that two poor people are not going to make a difference in a family, you know, especially with high unemployment rates of African American men. So it was really quite disruptive in terms of the academic world. I think it came out in maybe 65 or so, but it was an absolute, and Moynihan was a senator, but he was a former sociologist who worked for the, I think, State Department. And it was just horrible. It was just blatantly, blatantly racist. It was not the system that was the problem. It was these Black women raising these crazy Black kids that were the problem. So I think my question for Daniel might be, so can we put to rest the idea of the rotten apple?
I mean, I think so. In some of the work that I've done apart from this, what we talk about is less the rotten apple, but more about the rotten tree.
Yes.
About how you know, just by getting rid of one or two or three problematic officers doesn't necessarily change how the leadership, how the rules are built, how officers are compensated. There are these entire structures within the department that don't change by just removing one or two or three bad officers, that you still have a significant amount of misconduct that's built into the daily processes that the organization is involved in. Oh, I think you might.
One more question, I think. I'm being kind by saying one more question, but I probably have about 20 more. And I see Michael's hand is raised. So why don't you go, Michael, and I'll come back.
Great. Thank you, Mary. So one of the questions I have is how much access have you had to Michael Cox? Both, you know, I mean, he's such an interesting case study because of the sort of his good intentions in joining the police department, the actual reality that he found and the beating that he suffered, and then going through litigation against the department that he continues to work for. You know, it seems that not to mention coming back to lead that organization, that his insights would be critically important. But it seems to me that he's been somewhat reticent to talk about a lot of that outside of what was covered in the press. And there's an excellent book for the audience called The Fence by Dick Lehrer.
I haven't spoken much with him privately. I have seen him speak publicly, and I have heard him reflect on the incident and really everything that happened afterward with the department. Their inability, his inability to get any kind of traction at the initial investigation. And mostly, he just, like you say, really wants to put it behind him. You know, he talks about these uncomfortable moments he had in the department while the suit was unfolding itself. And all of the ugliness even before that, because I didn't mention all of the things that happened when he actually when internal investigators were sending out subpoenas to a lot of the officers who were there on the scene. It was at that point that he started to get death threats, intimidating phone calls. Officers showed up to his home. His tires were slashed, and it was really only after all of that happened that he decided to sue the city and the department. But I think in terms of how he sees that moment in history and how he sees his job as an officer now, I mean, it's like he doesn't see that moment. It's like he wraps up that moment as a blip in time, and it was an ugly scene, but it doesn't represent either his view on the city as a person or his ability to police the city and how he would go about it as a leader. He still very much sounds like a company man. If you talk to him, it's strange. I don't know that I could necessarily have that kind of emotional attachment to an organization that I would feel like turned its back on me and was, assaulted towards me. But, he does. He's obviously built different than I am. So, but that's the kind of engagement I have with him, just mostly publicly. I haven't had an opportunity to have him sit and reflect. I would love that. But that's not the kind of interview that he sits for very often.
I think just to follow
you're
up.
Muted. You're muted, Michael.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, Mary. Let me just follow up with this, because what happened to Michael Cox is actually pretty far too regular occurrence in police departments when Black officers are undercover or in plain clothes, they're mistaken for suspects. I worked in Providence, Rhode Island as an FBI agent. There was a Black officer killed responding to a crime in plain clothes, killed by other officers. And recently in St. Louis, during the Black Lives Matter protests, a Black undercover agent within the protests was caught in a kettle and severely beaten by police officers, mistaking him for a protester. Of course, they shouldn't have been beating the protesters either. Right. But it becomes very difficult to get any kind of accountability for that kind of action. And is your research looking at that problem, or is that problem continuing in Boston particularly, or other cities that you've?
I'm not really looking at that systematically around the country. I think that that's something that ought to be done. I think the longer term, the longer vision that we've had for this project is to kind of look at Boston from this time going forward, but from the perspective of different communities. So we want to look at the next stage of the research would kind of turn to the Latino perspective. Down the road, we also want to look at the transgender perspective and the gay perspective in the city, because I mean that's also not something that's been done from a criminological viewpoint, and there is a story to tell here from all the archival work that we've already been doing.
I think this question of Black or brown chiefs of police or sheriffs is intriguing. And I agree with you that that there seems to be a disconnect once they get to the top. But organizational theory and sociology tells us that they have to be that way in order to get at the top, or right. they don't get to the top.
Right.
I saw this in LA with Lee Baca, who is mm-hmm. now, I think he's out of prison now, but he was in prison. And the second Latino sheriff was Luna, and he just turned into a mad dog once he became the sheriff. And he kind of ran on a liberal kind of platform. And he's now trying to get back on because he was voted out. So I would just argue that you're never going to get an interview from a head of a department who is the head of the department. You're not going to get an interview to get the real answers because they become politicians and not just cops. And it's been shown over and over and over again. So I hope in your research that you will maybe explore that, because I think it's such an important point. And we've had one former head of a police department, Norm Stamper, who was, and he's written several books, but he was the chief, I think in Seattle, if I'm not mistaken. And he's just done a complete 180, but they got him out of there because he had very liberal views and they didn't like it, you know, so you're not guaranteed that you're going to stay there. So just my two cents in terms of the leadership of these departments.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
If no other questions, I have another one. Or if I just ask you to maybe expound on the Charles Stewart case. Because I watched a documentary several months ago, the newest, I think it was Frontline or maybe somewhere on PBS, maybe HBO, I'm not sure. But it was over several nights, I believe. And and what was done to the community was, I mean, they did such a great job of, because there are people who are alive today who were traumatized by that.
Oh, yeah.
So could you explain that a little bit more to our audience?
I mean, that was what, that was October of 89. And I actually live and run right near where that all went down. Brigham and Women's Hospital is Women's probably Hospital. One of the most renowned in the area. Mm-hmm. That's where Carol Stewart was leaving. She was pregnant at the time. They were just having an appointment there. And that's when Charles Stewart says that that someone jumped into the car when they were at a stoplight and drove them to a secluded area. Shot him and Carol, you know, killing her, but only injuring him, which that to anyone who was paying attention set off alarm bells from the very beginning, because why would you shoot and kill, you know, a woman who, and when you have like a 6 foot former football player who is a more immediate threat, right? If you're a full grown man. So there was just a lot of complications with the investigations initially. I think within a few hours, or actually within a few days, the mayor went on TV publicly and really just asked the police to be as aggressive as possible. So the encouragement from really came from the highest levels of power in the city, and it was at that point that the department didn't necessarily write a policy of stop and frisk, but they kind of told their officers, particularly one unit, the citywide anti-crime unit, to do what they had to do and to find and suss out the suspect. And they went systematically into that housing project, going from home to home. And in fact, Willie, when they found Willie Bennett's home, because he wasn't the only person arrested and accused of the crime, there was a number of others, including a former homeless man, Alan Swanson. But Willie Bennett got the brunt of it because they completely ransacked his home. That part is very well covered in that documentary. I mean, you see his mother kind of, you know, with the whole house torn apart right behind her. and she doesn't even know what's going on. They don't. And part of the challenge also was that Willie Bennett had a very checkered past, right? This was someone who had been involved in armed robberies before. He had several drug offenses on his record. He was well known to the officers of that citywide anti-crime unit. So to them, it kind of seemed like it was a slam dunk. But it also belies the fact that there was a lot of coercion involved on the part of the police to get evidence against Willie Bennett initially, because it was his nephew and another neighborhood boy whose testimony was used to ultimately try and convict him. While he was going throughout the trial, it was revealed that the husband had killed Carol Stewart because he committed suicide. And then the brother admitted that he helped to conceal evidence in the case, including all of her money and purse and wallet, which the husband said had been stolen, but you know had been given to the brother, including the murder weapon. So, after all of this broke, the community really, really lost a lot of trust in the department, and it was really in that time that the collection of Black clergymen kind of came together to try and make sense of what was happening in that situation at that time. Yes, Michael.
A question I have, one of the things that I've been looking at, typically that, as you mentioned, the high rates of violent crime in Black and brown communities justify these aggressive police actions or are used to justify the police actions. But typically when you look at police clearance rates, they're not solving the violent crimes that they're sent in to solve that supposedly justify these tactics. And yet there seems to be a disconnect between whether the or a lack of evaluation of whether the tactics are actually effective in addressing the problem that they claim justifies them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be winding up a little bit. If you had a comment about that, Daniel, because I wanted to ask you and LG a mutual question. Go ahead,
sure.
Please.
Well, I mean, I agree with that. The other wrinkle there is the community's lack of trust is also a reason why officers feel like they have to rely on that kind of tactic. Right at that time, the department did not really have a clear strategy on how to address the crime problem. The department, in fact, was denying that they had a gang problem or a drug problem at all. They were much more focused on Whitey Bulger and Italian-style mob crime and Irish-style mob crime. You know, that Black and Latino urban violence like we know it now was not really on their radar, right? They were kind of, at the time, arguing that that was more of a New York and LA thing. But you know, so the community's lack of trust for the department was one of the reasons that was encouraged. But then it was also, you know, the blowback that you received after even more aggressive tactics like that.
So LG, I'm going to assume, is closer to our students' age than you are. So I was just wondering, I mean, occasionally we'll ask our guests how they got from point A to point B. How did you get interested in this topic? How did you get interested in your area of study in school? Do you want to start, LG?
Sure. Yeah. I went to school initially for writing. And I chose to study the social sciences, because I think that, creative practices necessitate an understanding of people and society. And I kind of accidentally just fell in love with sociology. I think I've always sort of thought that way. So it was a very easy fit. And when I took intro to criminal justice with Professor Gascon, is when I got more into the criminology, criminal justice side of sociology. And
so he presented opportunities for you to help him with his research, and
yes.
The rest is history. Well, we're glad you did. We're glad you made that decision. I especially, because I'm a sociologist, and I know Daniel is a sociologist too. So good choice. Good choice. Daniel?
I wanted to become a police officer when I was studying at Cal State. You know, that was my whole motivation. You know, many people come out of that program in criminal justice wanting to become professionals in the criminal justice system of one type or another. But it was really in the process of working with faculty there that I kind of found research and fell in love with it. I was like working with faculty in the summer and learning how to, you know, fix data in Excel and do minor statistical analyses. And that was really it. You know, I found out that professors have much, you know, what I thought was like the summer's off completely. And I thought, wow, what a cool job. And I don't know, I got along with the faculty there. You know, I still, many of the people who were really influential to me, Tibbetts, Famega, Gisela Bickler, Seacrest, who's no longer with us, but and Brian Levin, like those, I was just cool with them on a personal level, and they felt, and I felt like I could do research along with them. Right. I think I kind of brought that a similar sensibility to the research that we are doing now. I think I wanted, because I started to learn more and more about the city of Boston, I wanted to kind of replicate the LA study that we did. And I also wanted to work more closely with students in a mentorship capacity. And I was offered some research funding. No one told me to do undergraduate focused research, but that was my goal. You know, I was teaching two sections of intro to criminal justice, and they gave me this opportunity to, with these funds. And I was like, hey, let me just talk to the students who I get along with really, really well in the class. And LG was one of them. I had another student at the time, JB Baez, who we also hired. And then from another introductory course, I hired Melanie Matoja. So all of my students were from, you know, initial undergrad courses, who were just very bright, very interested students, and who appreciated my critical perspective. And that was it. We were just all kind of vibing on the same wavelength. And that's how we made all these connections. Yeah.
Well, it's a good lesson for our students too. You know, you can't be shy. You've got to go to office hours, and you have to ask, you know, can I help you with your research, or can you help me with my research, whatever. But I mean, that's, I always used to say, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so, you know, there's this direct line between, let's say Edna Bonasich and what's going on at Harvard now, you know, because she was just such a wonderful sociologist and researcher. So unless there are other questions, panel, folks, what do you all think?
I'll ask one more. How much access to the Boston Police Department do you have? Have they been very transparent in sharing data?
No.
I don't think they have to think at all.
No, LG has tried to get a hold of them. They make it very difficult to get any kind of archival data. But so, sorry, go ahead.
I've tried to contact them to get to their archives, and I've found that they don't, first of all, most of the people there don't know about how the records are stored. They recently have outsourced some of their record storage to a private company. And they're also not a very open organization. I remember one of the first times I tried to call, someone yelled at me and hung up.
So yeah, it's not been easy. And I know that Jim Lehrer, who wrote The Fence, had to FOIA almost everything. We haven't gotten to that stage, but we're getting there. We're getting there pretty soon. We wanted to gather archival data. We still have a mind to do some interviews, and then we want to go back to the department.
Looks like we have a kind of fun question. Do you want to read it, Amber?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. We have a Q&A question. Anonymous is asking, have you seen the series The Wire?
Yes, I recently started watching this show with my wife. After 20 years of saying, no, I'm not going to watch it because I really hate procedural shows. I feel like they always get the facts wrong. But it's proving to be a very well put together show, and I really enjoy it. Yes, there's a lot. That show, we actually started watching that show because someone suggested watching We Own This City, which was another very recent police corruption case out of Baltimore. And both of those shows put together, that city has a much darker problem, I think, and their city, that their history needs to be teased out in a similar way. But yes, I've been watching that show and thoroughly enjoying it, I must say.
How about you, LG?
I have not watched The Wire.
I'm just kidding. I know, but if you get a chance, please check it out. Are we going out now, Amber?
Yeah, that's about it for the Q&A questions. Does anyone else have a question to ask or comment to make? Okay, well, thank you all so much. Again, this was so informative. I'll be sending this link to my students to review once we're done. I really thoroughly appreciated every aspect of the conversation.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Be well, and thanks for coming.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Everyone.